Okay, so our second representative for the state, Texas State Agencies segment is Lori Rottenberry, who's director of the Oil and Gas Division of the Railroad Commission of Texas. So, Lori, I'll let you take over.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. And I want to acknowledge Craig Pearson, one of your members, who works with me at the Railroad Commission in the Oil and Gas Division. He and I talked a little bit, and what I thought I would do today is just talk a little bit about who the Railroad Commission is, what the Railroad Commission does, what kind of issues the Railroad Commission has been addressing over the last 5 or 6 years, maybe 10 years, related to shale gas development in the state of Texas. And then I'm cognizant of the time. I want to leave a little bit of time for questions so that I can try to get the information to you that you're most interested in. I've got a number of slides here, including our mission statement that's available on our website. I'm not going to spend much time on that. I did want to mention we've got a long history as an agency and a long history regulating oil and gas exploration and production in the state of Texas. Just celebrated our 125th anniversary this year. I've got some pictures here of our current commissioners, many of whom you know because they have participated in various events sponsored by the various universities in the state of Texas. I'm happy to have had the opportunity to work with these folks. Just briefly to go over the jurisdiction. We regulate oil and natural gas exploration and production in the state of Texas. We are a regulatory agency. As such, our authorities and responsibilities are established by the Constitution and the laws of the state of Texas. I'll go into that in a little more detail in a minute. I also wanted to mention some related areas that do fall within the Railroad Commission's broader jurisdiction, including the pipeline industry, LP gas and compressed natural gas and liquid natural gas, natural gas utilities, and coal and uranium surface mining operations are also covered. But obviously we're focusing on oil and gas activities today. I included just a slide here just to give you a brief idea, a quick idea of the magnitude of our endeavors. And I'm talking here about 436,000 oil and gas wells that have been drilled and have not yet been plugged. These numbers do not include all of the other wells, all the hundreds of thousands of wells that have been drilled through the history of oil and gas development in Texas, but have since been plugged. We've got 311,000 or so oil and gas and service wells that are currently active. Those service wells include the injection wells and disposal wells that Peter had talked about earlier. We've also got about 125,000 inactive wells as of the end of August, including some wells that we call orphan wells. For the most part, when the wells reach the end of their productive life, the operators plug those wells as they should, as required by the regulations. There are some occasions, though, where a company goes bankrupt or the sole proprietor dies or for whatever reason, the well is left in an inactive status but not yet plugged, and we do have mechanisms at the Railroad Commission for plugging those wells using funds that are obtained from the oil and gas industry. And then there's the current count on production of oil and gas in the state of Texas on a daily basis, 2.7 million barrels of oil and 22 billion cubic feet of natural gas. Just a picture of the, I think you've seen something like this already today. I'm trying to remember which speaker had included a similar slide. There are about 1.3 million spots on this map that include oil and gas and service wells that have been drilled and also some permitted locations that may or were not drilled. Also, we've got the pipeline infrastructure in the state of Texas, 440,000 miles of pipeline that cross the state. You've seen some of these charts. I'm not going to go into them in detail other than to note that they do reflect some of the shale development in the state of Texas, the first hump beginning in 2002. Represents primarily the development of the Barnett Shale, the gas resources there. And then the second hump coming on later represents the oil shale development primarily in Eagleford and Permian and other parts of Texas. You've seen these, so I'm going to gloss through these right now and just talk briefly about the jurisdiction in more detail. The activities that are regulated by the Railroad Commission are those associated with oil and gas drilling and production operations. It includes what goes on at the well site. It includes the transportation of crude oil and natural gas and produced water by pipeline, also the hauling of the oil field waste over the public roads, and oil and gas waste management facilities. If you have questions about the division of jurisdiction between the Railroad Commission and the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, I refer you to the Memorandum of Understanding. It's been codified in our rules as Statewide Rule 30. It's available on our website. It's also been codified in TCEQ's rules. So if you have more detailed questions about a particular facility and who regulates it, I refer you to that document. I also wanted to highlight the things that are not under the Railroad Commission's jurisdiction, because we do get calls from people about various activities that fall outside the scope of our regulatory programs, notably roads and traffic, noise, odors, and lighting, all things that are extremely important topic, especially when you're talking about impacts on the communities. They are not, though, covered by the Railroad Commission's regulations. Air quality issues, TCEQ handles those. Mineral interests and leases and questions of property damages, those are questions that are private contractual matters. If there are disputes, those are resolved through the courts of the state of Texas and not through Railroad Commission administrative hearing processes. Also pipeline siting and railroads. It's been a number of years since we've had anything to do with the railroads, although we still get calls. As far as the purposes of the Railroad Commission's regulations, there are exceptions to this, and there are additional areas where we have some involvement. But if you want to remember what the Railroad Commission does, if you think about water protection and public safety and prevention of waste of oil and gas resources, you'll have 98% of our programs covered, because they fall in those three areas. Just to give you some idea about what we're talking about, when we talk about water protection, we're talking about rules for the casing and cementing and mechanical integrity of wells, oil and gas and injection wells. We're talking about the prevention and cleanup of spills, the management of waste generated in oil and gas exploration and production operations, and also well plugging and site remediation activities, most of which is done by the responsible operators, but we also have programs in place to take care of the abandoned sites. In the public safety arena, I've got two slides, actually. We address well control issues, spill prevention and response, and probably most critically, hydrogen sulfide safety, just because of the toxic nature of H2S gas. We also handle pipeline and alternative fuel safety. And I just had a slide in here to talk a little bit about the Railroad Commission's pipeline safety program. We do administer the federal pipeline safety program for the intrastate pipelines. The interstate pipelines are regulated directly by the Department of Transportation through its Pipeline Hazardous Materials and Safety Administration. And then the third prong of our regulatory arena, the waste prevention. This is the historical regulation on the spacing and production restrictions on oil and gas wells. I did want to mention we do regulate venting and flaring of gas for this purpose. If the concern is about air quality impacts, however, that would be an area for the TCEQ to address through its regulations. But we do have some venting and flaring regulations that are designed to prevent the waste of oil and gas resources. And then I just wanted to touch briefly on recent developments in a number of areas. These are all areas that the Commission has worked in the last 5 or 6 years, key issues that we've heard several previous speakers talk about a number of these issues. These are illustrative of the kind of work that's really being done by oil and gas regulatory agencies in states across the country to address issues that are arising related to shale development across the country. These are also areas, and I agree with Kathleen's statement, where in order to make good regulatory decisions, you need good data and you need good science. So in terms of the kind of work that a group like the Tamist Shale Task Force could help us with, these are just some of those areas in the state of Texas. Quickly run through these. September 2010 through July 2012, we had a series of rulemakings to address inactive wells. You saw in one of the earlier charts that right now we've got about 125,000 inactive wells out of the total inventory of 436,000. That number fluctuates a little bit based on the price of oil and the level of industry activity. But what we're concerned about here is that oil and gas operators take responsibility for their well inventories, both their active wells and their inactive wells. And so some requirements have been put in place to ensure that the state of Texas and the oil and gas operators in the state are taking care of those wells in the inventory, whether they're active or not. They include surface equipment removal requirements if the well has been inactive for certain periods of time. There are also some inactive well plugging incentives built into the rules and some financial assurance requirements. And this particular topic will be one that the legislature, we expect, will be discussing in the upcoming session. As far as hydraulic fracturing goes, the Commission is one of the oil and gas regulatory agencies across the country that is participating in the Frac Focus chemical disclosure website. In January 2012, new rules went into effect requiring the information to be posted on Frac Focus concerning the chemical constituents of hydraulic fracturing fluids. Texas was one of the very first states to start using Frac Focus. I think the number of states actively using the site now is up to about 20, and in five Canadian provinces as well are using Frac Focus. There are something like 113,000 well sites last time I looked that have been reported to Frac Focus, and about half of those are in the state of Texas. In April 2013, the Commission amended its recycling rules to encourage recycling of produced waters and other oil field waste. And we were trying to streamline the process for permitting recycling and also to specifically address produced water recycling. The prior sets of rules had required some pretty detailed permitting requirements on lease type recycling situation, and the prior set of rules also focused on the solid waste recycling and not as much on produced water recycling. So the commission amended the rules to try to make sure we were accommodating the potential for further recycling of produced waters and to try to streamline the process as much as possible by actually authorizing certain on-lease recycling activities, provided that they met the conditions of the rules. And if you follow those rules, then you wouldn't have to have an individual permit to do the on-lease recycling. So we were trying to remove some of the regulatory impediments to recycling operations in the state. As far as well construction goes, these are maybe the most significant amendments out of this whole group that I'm talking about. It all depends on your perspective. But effective May 2013, the commission amended the casing and cementing requirements, updating the requirements that had been in place for many decades to try to clarify the construction regulations for oil and gas wells, update the cementing requirements. We also added a requirement for mechanical integrity testing prior to hydraulic fracturing to try to address some of the concerns about that particular operation, and then updated some requirements for well control and blowout preventers. And just to give you a quick idea of one of the key provisions of this new set of requirements, the rules all along had very clearly required the isolation of the freshwater aquifer, that blue zone up there, the dark blue zone. The rules had also very clearly required the isolation of the productive zone. In some cases, though, it wasn't quite clear what operators were required to do to isolate some of the intervening zones that might be potential flow zones because they're corrosive or they're pressured or they have other characteristics of concern. So the rules were very clear that for wells going forward, those intervening potential flow zones had to be isolated with cement. And then we've talked already quite a bit about the risk of induced seismicity. The commission did take steps in October 2014 to amend the disposal well rules to address disposal in historically seismically active areas. We required applicants to provide additional data in the permitting process in these areas. And also clarified the Railroad Commission's authority to suspend or modify or terminate a permit in the event that it appeared that there was a strong risk that disposal operations were inducing seismicity or might be inducing seismicity. Since these rules went into effect, the commission has considered about 62 applications for disposal wells under the authority of these new rules. And just to put that into context, that's not a large number. We get about 1,000 injection well applications a year. So since November 2014, there have been 62 that have been filed in areas of historic seismic activity. What we've done with those applications, we've followed up, asked the applicant to provide additional data to help the applicant and the agency assess the risk of induced seismicity in that area. Out of those 62 applications, 42 have been approved, 32 with special conditions, such as more frequent reporting of injection pressures or volumes, or in a few cases, some additional seismic monitoring in the vicinity of the disposal well. We've issued about 10 permits for other disposal wells without conditions. Those were areas where we looked and we really didn't see that there was a substantial risk. In one case I'm thinking of, we looked at the historical record and determined what was showing up as an earthquake in the record was actually a refinery fire, explosion and fire at a nearby refinery. So we've looked at some permits and said the risk here doesn't support additional permit conditions. We've also had about 12 applications returned or withdrawn for whatever reason. The applicant decided not to pursue the application. And then we've got about 8 still pending, 2 of which have been protested, so they're going through the hearing process. We've done all of this with help from Craig Pearson. He's the injection permitting staff, has been doing the detailed legwork, but we've gotten advice from Craig on the questions of potential seismicity in the area. I also would like to point out we're working closely with Peter and other folks at TexNet and at CSER, and we're looking forward to continuing that collaboration because, again, we think the kind of data and analysis that group will provide will be extremely helpful to the people writing the permits or considering the permit applications for these disposal wells. I also wanted to mention we've been putting a lot of effort into increasing our outreach and improving our communications. And so I refer you to our website for a lot of data that is out there. We've got all kinds of data about actual production operations, but also descriptions of the various rules and the whys and the wherefores behind the rules and the various administrative procedures that accompany those rules. So take a look there if you need additional information. And with that, I think I had some other slides that should be available to you, but those were some background information.
Okay, that's great. So first a hand for our speaker. You're not going anywhere. Well, it depends. So we're open for questions. We have a few minutes. Okay, Cesar.
You mentioned the use of frac focus,
yes.
Right? How do you know that the amount of, the volume of liquids and other things are correctly entered into the database? What sort of monitoring or is there any inspection or verification that these numbers are correct?
We are able to audit, if you would like to describe it as that, on a case-by-case basis. We've got reporting mechanisms in place. The operators work with the service providers to actually put the data into the format required in order to post the data on FracFocus. So there's some mechanisms involved just in the process to ensure that the correct data gets posted. We do look to verify that FracFocus data has been filed as part of the well completion review process. At this point, we're not doing it for every well, but we're spot checking on that. And then we do have the ability to ask the operator for the detailed information as needed to investigate a concern or a complaint or an incident.
You mentioned that you have jurisdiction over inactive wells also.
Yes.
When wells are no longer operative, does the Railroad Commission require plugging of those wells?
Yes,
and
we do.
And also surface restoration of the well sites, the well pads. Is that part of your jurisdiction as well?
Yes, it is. I mentioned in terms of our water protection rules, we have requirements that talk about when you have to plug and how you have to plug and what you have to do with the surface facilities.
About one more minute. Anybody else? Okay, maybe you're off the hook now.
Okay,
that was
you.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.